You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
A heads up to Audiobook Club listeners, for our next meeting on April 25th, we'll be reading Moonwalking with Einstein, a nonfiction title about the limits of human memory by Joshua Foer. So get reading, but not until you've enjoyed this discussion of Swamplandia. This episode of the Slate Audiobook Club is brought to you by Squarespace.com, the fast and easy way to publish a high-quality website or blog. For a free trial, go to squarespace.com/slate.
Hello and welcome to the Slate Audio Book Club for March 28th. We are going to discuss Karen Russell's new novel, Swamplandia, big exclamation point at the end of that title. I'm here with Hannah Rosen, Slate's double X editor, my co-conspirator, and John Dickerson, Slate's political correspondent, chief guru in all things. Hey, guys.
Hi.
I want to be called the chief in the context of this
book.
He's
your co-conspirator, too, in a different way.
It's true. You guys are both my co-conspirators, and I'm so lucky in that. So I'm hoping one of you is going to give a nice kind of opening summary of the plot of this book, or at least sort of what you took as the main theme of this book. Perhaps we can start there.
I will start. I am going to say outright that I, recognizing all the flaws of this novel, really, really liked it. And so that's going to color my summary, and I'm going to put myself out there for you guys to criticize and take me down. This novel is told through the eyes of a preteen girl whose name is Ava, and her family goes by the name of Big Tree, and her father, who is Chief Big Tree, and they run an amusement park that's essentially an alligator swamp called Swamplandia, and thus the title of this novel, and thus the exclamation point in this novel. And the novel is about how Ava, who's coming into adulthood, starts to learn the truths about her family, the truths about alligator wrestling, and how the family mythology, which has been so painstakingly built up by her father, Chief Big Tree, and her mother, Halola Big Tree, who dies quite early in the novel, all starts to unravel. And we see this through her eyes. And I think it's quite a wonderful novel. And I'm actually very moved by this theme of reality and unreality, of the mythology breaking down. The idea of telling what I think is a very universal truth, both about coming of age and about human life in general, through such a quirky, eccentric set of characters really moved me. But we're starting too deep into the novel. Emily, can you tell us a little bit about what you thought about the family dynamics early on in the novel? Do you find them to be believable? Were you drawn in by this set of eccentric characters? And you can just say who the characters were, too.
Right. So let's outline this a little bit. Ava has an older sister named Osceola and an older brother named Kiwi, and they've grown up on Swamplandia, on this alligator-ridden island. They've been homeschooled there by their mother, Halola Big Tree, and their father, and then there's a grandfather charmingly named Sawtooth. And the family, you know, they do a little bit of book learning, but mostly they're out there taping the jaws of alligators shut and taking care of these 98 alligators and hanging out together.
And practicing their very campy show. I mean, their campy show just moved me to no end. I mean, it involves Halola Big Tree, who's a fairly somber and somewhat beautiful. She's not described as being sort of excessively, mythically beautiful, but the beauty is in the act and how she stands on this diving board Howard and her father's love. Chief Bigtree is expressed through this spotlight which follows her. This becomes a metaphor for love later on in the novel. And she dives into the alligator swamp and the crowd gasps. And that's basically the campy nature of Swamp.
And then swims through.
And then swims through the alligators. Right, right, right.
I actually really love the opening passage of this book. This book has some lovely writing in it. And this is an example. John, do you have the book in front of you? Would you read a little bit from the very beginning?
From the very beginning. Oh, my gosh. It's a public reading. Our mother performed in starlight. Whose innovation this was, I never discovered. Probably it was Chief Bigtree's idea. And it was a good one. To blank the follow spot and let a sharp moon cut across the sky unchaperoned. To kill the microphone. To leave the stage lights tin eyelids scrolled and give the tourists in the stands a chance to enjoy the darkness of our island. To encourage the whole stadium to gulp air along with Swamplandia's star performer, the world-famous alligator wrestler Helola Bigtree.
Yes.
That
yes,
was super. Hello. You are such a good reader out loud. I want you to come read bedtime stories at my house. You asked a question, Hannah, about the relationships among the characters and how real they felt, how compelling they are. I will start out by saying that I found Helola Bigtree to be quite underdeveloped in the book. She plays this incredibly important role. She's the linchpin of this family mythology, which you're right, is an incredibly important part of the book. And I don't think it's giving too much away to say that she dies of cancer fairly early in the book. And as a result, we only see her through Ava's eyes, remembering her. And I found the picture that emerged to be quite fuzzy. What do you guys think about that?
But I thought that was kind of the point, is that,
I know.
Is that she is a creation. I mean, since this whole book is about myths, the myths we tell ourselves, the sustainability of those myths, even when they're punctured, you need her to exist almost entirely as a myth, either in Ava's eyes or on the posters that you hear about, in the museum they have at home. Everybody has their little piece of the mother. Ava has the memory of her, and Ava wants to be an alligator wrestler like her mother. She obviously feels the tug the most strongly. Kiwi has the poster of his mother when he leaves Swamplandia. He has the poster of her that is in his dorm room. Aussie wears her wedding dress when she goes off to follow her ghost.
One of the things I really liked about this novel is the changing relationships with the tourists. I promise I'm coming around to John's point here. What you learn is that, you know, they hate the tourists at first. They're disgusting. They leave things. They're annoying. You know, they feel about the tourists sort of the way a waitress feels about her clients. And then over time, they come to miss and love the tourists and connect with them in a new way. And you realize that they didn't, the bits and pieces that they have and construct of their mother are not radically different than the bits and pieces that the tourists have and construct about Helola Bigtree, that they're really piecing together a myth and trying to discover the truth of it and using costumes such as a wedding dress and posters. They're hanging on to the same things that the tourists are hanging on to, but they're just imbued with so much more emotion than they are for the tourists. So I thought that was really quite a lovely thing, is to make Helola Bigtree this absent. You need the mother to be dead, basically, for this novel to take off.
Then the question is, what do we think of the other three, the three kids? And then, well, and then I guess the chief
also. And their
also.
Father.
And the father. I felt like, you know, Ava, we can talk about her. She's obviously the core of this book. And there are two different ways you can relate to her, both as a narrator and then as a character. But we can talk about that later. I thought she, you know, was obviously the most fully realized.
And she's a typical kind of Bildungsroman protagonist, right? We're watching her at this cusp of, if not adulthood, this kind of liminal moment into becoming a more grown up, fully realized person.
She's quite wise. She occasionally breaks voice. Karen Russell does. She occasionally gives her too much knowledge about, say, the Army Corps of Engineers, or, you know, a rant about what's been done to Florida swamps. But for the most part, I feel like her voice is the voice of the classic, you know, coming of age protagonist. And Kiwi and Aussie fit around that as, you know, not stock, I wouldn't say, but Kiwi is a kind of overly cynical, sees too hard through the myth, and Aussie is completely destroyed and launched into fantasy land in a kind of demented way. And so, you know, one is up in the air, one is firmly grounded, and eventually that doesn't ultimately matter in terms of their fates, but that's what they serve as bookends to Ava.
The interesting thing about the choice of the narration, there are two narrators. There's Ava, and then there's the omniscient narrator. Aussie never gets her own voice.
Yes.
She's always told through Ava, which is an interesting choice, and relegates her to the sort of third-rate status, if Hilola's in fourth-rate status in terms of how fully developed Osceola is in third. Kiwi gets his own omniscient narrator, and so he – what's interesting to me is Ava's voice is like Ava. It's too knowing in some cases and then totally naive in others. And she is strong enough to wrestle alligators and yet totally naive about so many other things. And so I felt like there were times when it would switch from the omniscient narrator to Ava's voice and you'd say, this is essentially the same voice. But then it was clear that Russell was trying to do this thing, I felt, that matched both Ava's development, which is sort of in one case these super developed muscles and these other weak ones, the voice kind of matched that, which I thought was pulled off in some cases, and if not pulled off fully, was a pretty clever attempt, and you know, so A for effort.
That's very generous. I mean, I wouldn't say a lot of that was conscious, that you'd get sliding back and forth sometimes between omniscient and Ava in a way which wasn't extremely controlled, but I'm not going to be the skeptic here because, Emily, I'm sensing that you're the skeptic here and that what you said about the mom was just a sort of petulant way to get into your skepticism.
Petulant!
So just have
you're
it
calling
out.
Me petulant!
Well,
you're
she's
really...
dead, honey. Like, give her a break.
To have a fight.
Anyway, so go ahead.
Right. If I'm going to criticize the dead mom, exactly. Why am I not going to go after? Yes, I wanted to like this book much more than I actually did. I found the plot to be quite contrived at various moments and in a way that felt to me like I could feel the machinery moving. And that put me off. My biggest complaint has to do with the use of ghosts in the book, which I'm eager to hear your opinions of. And Hannah, you better come up with one rousing defense for it. But in my own view, and now I believe I am stealing a line from John Dickerson, if you're going to use ghosts, you have to really, you better make something of them, because once they show up, we're a little skeptical, as long as we're not in Harry Potter land. And this is not Gabriel Garcia Marquez here, or even Toni Morrison. I was trying to think what other authors to pull into the discussion. And those are both writers who, in their magical realism, justify the use of the supernatural, I think, over and over again. Whereas the ghosts here just annoyed me. And we should explain what the ghosts are doing, I suppose. John, can you do that? And I hope you're going to second me here. And if not, go ahead.
I agree, especially since you quoted me. I can't possibly climb down from that now.
Yes, that was a good trick I pulled.
Well, obviously, the biggest and most important ghost is the mother, right? But she doesn't play a walk-on role like Lewis Thanksgiving. Lewis Thanksgiving was a worker on a dredge that was clearing out the swamp who died in the most extraordinary way, which I don't really even still – there was an explosion on the dredge.
We don't know if Ossie
we
made
don't know
that
how
story.
He died.
Yeah, exactly.
We don't know anything
don't,
about
him.
I love the ghost, and I'm going to get to
anyway,
that in a minute.
Ossie falls in love with Ossie falls in love with Lewis. Ossie falls in love with Lewis Thanksgiving, who may or may not exist. So she falls in love with him, and she goes off to see him. And do we give away what happens in the very
yeah,
end?
Yeah, we give
no?
away everything
okay.
in the book club.
All right. Well, so there's a huge chunk of the book that is Ava going after to find Ossie. And she takes this trip with this man known as the Birdman, who, by the way, to the extent that everybody has mythologies, right? The Birdman, at one point, Ava says, tore off his last name. So did Lewis Thanksgiving. So did the family. The Big Tree family is originally from Ohio, but they throw away their heritage and become, you know, essentially sort of quasi-Indians. So
pretend
it's like
Indians.
All, yeah. Pretend Indian. So everybody in the book has a kind of identity that they've mixed and matched and played around with. And so the Birdman is like this as well. They go off on this hunt into what's supposed to be the underworld and after Ossie, who's run off with Lewis Thanksgiving. And then I guess the third ghost is the washerwoman with the line, and I can't remember her name now.
The Swamp Mama.
The Swamp Mama, yes. The Swamp Mama who
well, I thought she was real.
Is real. But again, it's this whole is the
she's
ghost,
a ghost
the ghost.
Too.
But that's the thing is that, okay, so Ava thinks that this woman, the swamp woman, is a ghost and has harmed her sister. And so it's in a moment of distress, which we can get to more fully in a minute.
Having to do with the laundry.
Right. And so she freaks out. And then later it's revealed that this woman, in fact, was just a woman who picked up the clothes that had freaked Ava out. She picked them up because Ossie had lost her bag in the water. So they went down the river. This woman picked them up, put them
Wait,
on the clothesline.
I'm going to interrupt your plot summaries here because the thing that you guys are purposely leaving out in order to make this plot seem absolutely absurd is that Ossie, who is falling in love with a series of ghosts, is mentally ill. And that's one of the things I really liked. I am not a fan of magical realism. I don't have that much patience for it. But in this case, you have, you know, a girl who is deeper into her sexual awakening. There are moments when her sister is clearly masturbating and Ava doesn't realize it. Her sister experiences these moments as a kind of ecstasy. But she she's also stuck in this isolated place where she's essentially been spottily homeschooled for most of her life, and she's going slowly mad. She's clearly a young schizophrenic or something. She has mental delusions, which she experiences as these ghosts. And I was so moved by the story of Louis Thanksgiving Auschwitz. I actually.
But where does it come from if he's not real?
She's Hold mentally on. Ill.
But where voice do you, is it in?
It's Ossie is making up a story that's confusingly, just like the confusion between the omniscient narrator, it's a little bit confusing. She's crossing into the omniscient narrator. It's becoming larger than Ossie. I mean, one of the things that happens is in the way myths get out of control and in the way kind of, you know, the myth of the chief big tree gets out of control, myths and reputations kind of balloon in this novel and then they get punctured and they kind of take on a life of their own and then they get instantly deflated. And we'll talk about what happens when they get deflated and what's on the other side of the myth when we get to talking about Kiwi, which is the latter half of the novel. But essentially, we don't know where that story comes from. We don't know if Ossie read it in one of her books in the floating library, because she does fall in love with actual dead people who are part of the town mythology. We don't know if she just kind of became enraptured with this rusty dredge boat that they found. And so she invented this entire myth, but she's captivating Ava. This is a kind of test of will between sisters, where Ossie is making up a story so fantastic and full of so many rich details. There's a tension between Ava. Do you believe me or not? And that becomes a kind of test of love. And also sexuality and madness are linked in this book in so many ways that I thought that it really gets encapsulated. There's a line about Louis Thanksgiving Auschwitz, who's out working in the swamps and is like delighted to be out working in the swamps. I mean, this made up person. And she says he was trying to make his past into good theater. Lots of novels do this, right? They have a kind of mini narrative within the narrative, which encapsulates the themes of the entire novel, as does his story, you know?
Ava buys the story thoroughly, so thoroughly that she then spends, you know, 150 pages seeking Ossie, who she thinks has gone down into the underworld. So perhaps she does buy, you know, so she it's an act of love for her. I'm not sure whether the mental illness part of it, because Ava takes it so seriously, I kept looking for another, you know, I kept looking for trying to figure out this is more than just a sister going after her crazy other sister.
I was willing to go for that part of it, but my problem is that this story about Louis Thanksgiving is filled with all this incredibly rich historical detail. I did not believe for one second that Osceola could have told the story. There's nothing in the book that leads us to think she is this kind of storyteller. She's carrying around this like ridiculous Ouija board, if that's how you say that word.
And Ouija, honey. Ouija. Didn't you Ouija. Grow up in the seven? What kind of slumber parties did you go? What were you doing at your slumber parties? It's a Ouija board.
We were too busy playing. What's that game? Light as a feather, dry as a bone. We didn't have Ouija boards.
You were playing hockey.
Okay. That's my children.
But, you know, she has this like spiritist handbook that she's not reading Depression era history, which is what this is. I felt like the author got a little carried away in terms of what her own excitement about this Depression narrative she created. It's really compelling. And I love stories within stories, but I'm sorry, I'm just being the dunderheaded literalist here. They can't spring fully formed from the mouths.
But in a book about the power of myth, I thought
no,
that was
I don't
okay.
care. The power of myth does not excuse this for me. I felt like repeatedly this book was asking me to excuse flaws in it because of the power of myth. And I'm sorry.
I think that's fair.
Okay. Now, speaking of the power of myth, we're going to pause for a word from our sponsor. If only Louis Thanksgiving had a website. This episode is brought to you by Squarespace.com, the fast and easy way to publish a high quality website or blog. For a free trial, go to Squarespace.com/slate. Squarespace.com is the fast and easy way to create and manage a high quality website or blog. If only Swamplandia had its own website, they might still be around today. It might not have fallen apart as a theme park. Create a website that's unique to you to display your photos from Flickr, a blog you've been thinking about starting, or the tweets and RSS feeds you like most, all in the design and colors of your choice. Whatever you want to communicate, you can say it easily and with style with Squarespace. And they have an iPhone app, which makes it easy to update your site on the go. Try it out today for free. Visit squarespace.com/slate and sign up for their free trial. Then choose a design template to get started. No credit card needed. Just give it a try to build your website. That's squarespace.com/slate to sign up for a free trial. We thank Squarespace for their support. Okay, let's get back to the show. There was no internet in this, by the way. I was thinking about that. Like I don't know what year this novel was supposed to take place, but there's a great moment where she's trying to figure out whether the alligator wrestling competition ever happened. And I was like, Ava, Google it, honey. Yeah. Like, just look online and it will answer your question
for
you.
They do not have the internet on that island.
Well, that was the other
they
thing.
Had a telephone.
But that was also the beauty of the island in some ways, which is that its sense of it out of time. I mean, it was completely an island. It was an island in time, an island physically, you know, their own little world. So it was – you could imagine that the internet existed constantly on the mainland, but that they just hadn't gotten that far yet.
One of my favorite details in this book is that the family has erected a museum to itself on the island. And so all of its possessions are suddenly historical artifacts. They're the stuff of legend. And then they start taking things back out of the museum when they need a birthday present or whatever. I thought that was a kind of lovely rendering of the mythology.
So, Emily, since you are not captured by the myths the way I am and John Halfway is, why don't we move on to when they start to puncture
nice claiming of John there.
No, half.
Good work, sister.
Half. Yeah. Half. I said half. He's not as skeptical. Anyway, John can speak for himself. Let's move on to where they start to puncture the myth, which is essentially the way that this novel moves. In this moment where you have Ossie falling in love with the Dredge Man and deciding she's going to marry the Dredge Man and that he is the one, you have three other simultaneous moments of sexual awakening going on. One is Ava's horrible one with the Birdman. That's where my skepticism comes up. I know why it was necessary for that kind of sexual moment to happen, but I really did not buy. Wait. And then there was Kiwi with the girl who he supposedly rescues in the theme park, who's kind of like a bratty, you know, Pippa Middleton sort of society girl with brown hair who, you know, insists on sleeping with him because he rescued her from the pool. And it's a sort of reality TV. That's when you're taken into the real, real world with Kiwi. So do you want to talk about what happens to Ava and the Birdman first, or do you want to talk about Kiwi?
Well, I also think we need to set the stage here a little bit. One of the key parts of this book is that not only has the mother died, the father disappears. He goes off to the mainland, presumably to get and in fact to earn money, leaving Ava and Osceola by themselves on the island because Kiwi, the older brother, has already left. And that splintering of the family is crucial to what actually happens, right?
And the father took those trips even when the mother was alive, and later Kiwi learns that this is another puncturing of the myth, the idea that Swamplandia was itself a going concern when the mother was alive. The father was still having to make these trips into town to work as a sort of like a barker in a cut-rate sort of casino. But he sort of ran this icky beauty contest. I want to ask you guys, though, about the sexual – so Ava's raped by this guy, the Birdman, who comes to tend to the birds on the Swamplandia property, and she enlists his help in finding Osceola in the trip down into the underworld. And he takes her on a long trip, guiding her and telling her about the dangers going into the underworld. And then finally, he rapes her. Now, I saw that coming the minute we met the Birdman.
Of course. Yeah. In fact, it was excruciating that it took so long.
Exactly. So that I felt was a huge clunk, a thud coming down in the middle of the book. Although the rendering, back to the language quickly, her description of the rape, Ava's narration of the rape, I thought was amazing in terms of being strange, peculiar, out of body. I mean, obviously, I have no firsthand knowledge with this, but it rang. You know, there were lots of other places where the language didn't ring true at all. And in this case, it felt I was completely in that moment. There were a couple of other – I felt that with the drowning scene too. But anyway.
I felt horrible. I felt like you did. So essentially, I almost knew it was coming, but I really hoped it wasn't going to happen because the Birdman was so thoroughly asexual that I knew that when it did happen, it was not going to be believable. On the other hand, you know, I had the same experience almost as Ava. Ava is sort of drawn to the Birdman even after it happens as her only – she's a kid for one thing. So she feels some obligation towards adults to follow what they say still because she's still a kid. kid. And she's also needs him. I mean, she's out there in the wilderness. She needs – he's created this whole notion that they're in the underworld, so she feels terrified, and he's the only person who's been her protector. She's
and
colluded
also, she
with him.
She barely has parents at
she
this
barely
point.
Has
she's
parents.
Lonely.
And she says she loves – you know, she's kind of fallen in love with him as some kind of crazy father figure. And so I really, really didn't want to happen. But then, like John said, the way it happened made me – you know, I really didn't want it to happen. But then the way it happened was so kind of weirdly right and beautiful and bizarrely so that I felt icky even having that feeling. But it's true. I mean, the one thing that I thought was amazing is when she hears her mother's voice. I mean, speaking of the perfect use of ghosts, you know, she looks at the Birdman's face the moment before it's going to happen. And this is amazing. And she says, I couldn't remember how to see this face as friendly anymore, because his face has been this kind of blank slate that she's been interpreting in all these different ways. And suddenly she couldn't grasp the friendliness. Karen Russell is a beautiful writer, by the way. There are some sentences and descriptions of all sorts of things, senility, old age homes that I just are incredibly memorable and beautiful. But she hears her mom's voice and her mom says, I can read the whole thing, but he says, the Birdman is just a man, honey. I mean, he speaks like it's such a mom's voice that she hears in her head. And that's when you feel like Ava's becoming a woman in some weird way. She's hearing her mom's voice correctly, not in mythology, and she's identifying with her mom's voice. She hears it, you know, exactly as if her mom were still there.
And yet that mythology is still powerful to her later when she's running away from the Birdman, because she summons it when she goes through this, you know, birth canal, essentially.
Right. And if you didn't see
that, there was a huge neon sign that comes with the book and says birth canal.
Right.
Anyway, when she's running away, she pulls on the mother's mythology. So you can recognize that myth has been punctured and is therefore doesn't have the same value. And yet it can still have in its component parts these things that still glow that you can still access, which she clearly does, even though she comes to this more adult understanding.
But see, that's what
mom.
I love about the novel is sort of what happens in all its flaws. And it's kind of when I read it the second time, I sort of realized how thin it was. I was so drawn to it the first time and to the whole world. And the second time, the plot seemed creaky to me and I realized the mother died in the first page. And then it's all this sort of weird putting together of these, you know, it just didn't quite work as well. But I love that idea that when you puncture the myth, you know, then you're still drawing on little bits and pieces of it. Yeah. And what's on the other side of the myth, which is also handled crudely, we haven't talked about Kiwi yet and we will in a second, you know, is it, that she did with a very like punch, you know, but it's important to know. Like, it's not just that you
I'm
puncture the myth
you.
And go on to your realistic life.
No, I'm agreeing with you. I think that's right. I agree with that. And I thought that was well rendered and true. So yeah, I agree.
Can I read this passage from the mother? Because I liked it. It stuck with me so much. The Birdman is just a man, honey. This is Ava hearing her mother's voice. He's more lost out here than you are. The Birdman has no idea where he's taking you, and if he does, well, that's much worse, and you won't find your sister anywhere near here, Ava, and I would run, honey, personally. I love that. I love that.
Right, and then there's this beautiful description as she comes out of the birth canal where she says, in the cave, I think she must have lent me some of it, her courage, because the strength I felt then was as huge as the sun, the yellow inside you that makes you want to live. And it's also very moving. I will admit that. I agree. I agree about that part of it. I think this book has flashes of, you know, of real intense raw emotion in it.
Before we get to Kiwi, can I just say on the writing, there were times where, you know, she dropped in these little, you know, nuggets that were gorgeous. I mean, when she talks about Kiwi's friend having a break time smile,
right.
Like, it requires a real understanding of, like, to understand that that's a different kind of smile. And so in that case, there were these instances where it was just beautiful. At one point, there was something that was like swallowing a gallon of melted pennies, which I thought, wow, that's, you know, that just – and then – interspersed with each one of those were things like where she said, I watched one sentence come after another, like knotted magician scarves. And I thought, trying too hard.
Right, right.
And then there would be another great one. And then there would be, you know, like neighbors coming up to the stars of a barbed fence. And I thought,
she loves
like
the metaphor, right?
And I thought, everything can't be like everything else, or else we're just going to be – this sentence is like a sentence after a sentence.
Right.
I mean, this is a young writer who's developing her novelist sense, and we'd rather have her erring on the side of too much than too little, right?
Yeah. I mean, not necessarily. I mean, I don't like the ones where she gets too big, like the swallowing the sun ones are the ones that thudded for me. But then it's the ones where she deals with actually universal family moments. Like, she talks about about lying to her dad, lying to Chief Big Tree, was like going on freezing a lake of ice and skating over it. And I love that idea of like, you're just trying to skate over that. Like, you're just trying to get quickly through that lie. It feels all wrong. You feel wobbly while you're doing it, and you just want to get to the other side. I thought that was quite brilliant. And she has a description of Grandpa Sawtooth senility, where she describes his memory as blinking on and off like the weird erratic energy of a light bulb in a torment. And I thought, oh, that's really great. I mean, the way that when you have someone who's senile, you know, it all feels wrong, and the sort of energy of them coming at you, and sometimes they're seeing things and then just as quickly they're not seeing things. Even her description of Victorian dresses as lizard frilled dresses, I thought was really, really great.
A good swamp simile. So let's talk a little bit about the mainland. Kiwi absconds. He then becomes a trader by doing the only kind of paid work he can get at this kind of totally cheesy amusement park where everyone has deserted Swamplandia to go to this place, which is called World of Wonders.
No, World of Darkness.
No, World of Darkness.
Thank you.
Yes,
sorry.
Because there's the, you know, there's the trip to the underworld, and then there's the trip to the underworld,
right.
The campy underworld and the sort of invented underworld. You know, they're both kind of mythologies. One is a horrible, disgusting, gum-filled amusement park, and, you know, The other is a
scary swamp.
Exactly.
And Kiwi's coming of age has to do with becoming a normal teenager. It's figuring out how to relate to other boys his age, how to tell them to go fuck themselves every other sentence so that they will not torment and terrorize him because he just seems like such a freak show. What did you think of this part of the narrative, John?
I like the break from Ava's voice, frankly. I kind of liked Kiwi, and maybe it's just because I'm a boy that I did, although I don't think so.
No, I liked Kiwi too.
I had all kinds of trouble with Ava. For me, one of the tests of a great novel that is at least the writing I like is that after you read a certain number of pages, you start walking around and the narrator in your head is seeing things and describing them the way the narrator in the book did. And there's something that lasts. And I thought the narrator with Kiwi was like that. And I felt like all of the constructs of the Kiwi section were not as kind of blatant and watch me write, watch me set this up. Now, the whole Jonah in the whale, at the world of darkness, there is this huge Leviathan. And so it seemed to me like the flashing neon sign was, you know, the story of Jonah in the whale, right? He goes into the belly of the whale and has these revelations and comes out.
He rebels against his father.
Against the father, the Jesus,
has to brush
the chief.
The whale's teeth.
Right. And so I was kind of like, on one hand, I was kind of like, okay, great, I got it, Jonah. And then on the other hand, I was like, well, wait, but I was trying to, then I spent all my time trying to connect the dots. And so that slightly irritated me. But anyway, I thought the drowning scene was the 100 pages before it had been kind of leading up to this moment, which I felt like every sentence was
nailed
perfectly. So Kiwi is slowly moving his way up the ladder at this horrible amusement park, and he finally gets sufficiently trained. He's a striver, and he's trying to get enough money to save Swamplandia. He even when he has 14 bucks, he sends it to the bank that his dad owes all this money to try and keep it going. And one of the ways he's going to survive is to either go work at the burger joint across the street, or he's going to learn how to be a lifeguard, and then he's going to learn how to fly these. So his strivery ends up, in a sense, saving the family in a way, and we can talk about
and
that.
And definitely saving Osceola.
Right, definitely saving Osceola, but also, his sister's saved by the Rangers. Anyway, he's a lifeguard, and a girl starts to drown in this.
Emily
starts to drown in the blood-red swimming area, and he dives in and has this kind of confused he's kind of rescuing her, but almost by accident, really. And then
I thought he really was rescuing her.
Yeah, no, I think he was. He didn't realize it. It was reaction. And it's interesting because Ava's the one who's the gator wrestler, and he's the kind of non-athletic, never really participates in the show, right? He's kind of an outcast in terms of the family's athleticism. Of course, Ossie is too, but compared to Ava. And yet he's the one who pulls off this great feat. He becomes kind of a celebrity.
It's unclear whether he pulls off the feat. What is clear is that he and Emily collude in the kind of modern day reality, not reality, I guess it's more talk show version.
The Geraldo moment.
Yes, yeah, so they have a Geraldo moment, and they sort of mutually create a Geraldo moment for a show which is called Jenny Just Spills It, among other shows. So you don't really know what happened under there, except that Emily really is going to China collude with Kiwi in making this a big damn deal.
And right? It's another myth. And so we have a myth, you know, myth creation inside this new narrative. In one sense, he's reluctant to participate in it. And yet all these bountiful things come is his friends stop calling him Margaret Mead, which is a very – actually, the funny thing about the Margaret Mead joke is very knowing and sort of – elite for his friends to be calling him that, which – and they're all sort of knuckleheads supposedly. But anyway, he gets – you know, they call him by his real name. He has – this leads to his first sexual encounter, which also is, I thought, well described.
He had to duck the chandelier of her jewelry to find her lips. You're not supposed to like this Emily character.
I didn't – I liked better the line about when he's moving in and he stops his hand and it says he left his hand there like a bookmark.
Right.
I thought that was – that was better for me than the chandelier. I thought, you know, that's – and also because the chandelier is kind of a, you know, that but bookmark, you don't expect the word bookmark to come in the middle of it.
Right. But it would occur to Kiwi, who's sort of, you know, who lives kind of, he's way too cerebral for the situations he finds himself in. Now, let me interrupt to ask a girl question, Emily. You know, in the twinning of sort of what happens to all of these characters, one thing I wasn't sure how I felt about was the fact that the sexual awakening happens in a completely destructive way for the girls. I mean, sort of tragically so for Ava, almost tragically so for Aussie, who's completely demented in her sexuality, and triumphantly for Kiwi. And I didn't know what to think about that. Like, why Kiwi gets off so easy? You know, he's out there slumming it with his buddies, including the requisite American, you know, Indian, not American Indian, but Indian person, which there's always a sort of Indian sidekick in every sitcom, which Karen Russell must be aware of. He's like the character from Parks and Rec.
Vijay
is like the character from Parks and Rec. So I don't know, what do you feel about that? There was such a danger around female sexuality and such a kind of comedy, you know, a sort of sitcomedy about Kiwi's first sexual encounter.
And I'm not sure if it's a problem in the book, because it's not as if that can't be one way of thinking about boys and girls' sexuality, but it certainly feels uncreative. It's sort of, you know, the Caitlin Flanagan ruined girl trope of female sexuality. And I think for me, it also linked up with the children's feelings about their parents. We see Kiwi really rebel against his father and then actually punch his grandfather, or sort of in self-defense, almost strangle his grandfather. We really see the men kind of go to war, and we see Kiwi deal with that, whereas the girls are much more in this situation of kind of passively waiting to be rescued, wanting their father to come back. It's much more of the kind of loving, dependent daughter relationship.
Yeah, I mean, the girls are in great danger in an island without men, and the men are not in great danger in an island without women. I mean, they're
well,
sort
I
of
guess
fumbling
so, but
around,
this was but why I resented the Birdman and the fact that the minute you know the minute he shows up, he spells doom and disaster. I mean, 13 or 12 year old girls are just not supposed to go off with strange men, particularly strange men who are wearing some smelly old coat covered with bird feathers. This cannot end well. And I don't know. I just didn't. That just didn't do it for me.
Mm-hmm. John, do you have anything to say on that, the boy girl element? Because if not, I want to talk about Grandpa Sawtooth.
No, let's move on to Grandpa.
Well, there's
Sawtooth.
Two other great incidents to talk about. One is the one where Kiwi encounters his father at the gaming resort. That's an incredibly sad moment, partly because he is using the same language that he used to introduce Halola Bigtree. This woman has more talent in her pinky finger than you have. You know, see, Kiwi hears these phrases that his father used so lovingly, and, you know, Halola and Chief Bigtree had a complicated relationship, and there's really, I think, very poignant ways in which Ava starts to realize the complications of her parents' relationship. But in the moment of the show, there was some kind of deep, earnest sincerity in his, and the spotlight following Halola. It's supposed to be both sort of suffocating and beautiful and romantic all in one. Whereas now he's using that same language transported into the most pathetic, sad situation of these women who are, you know, who are or aren't prostitutes, who are or aren't sort of sadly strutting across the stage. So that was a
very
sad.
And it's this moment
sad.
Of kind of dark realism in the book, because you realize it's also faded in the book, this family is going to lose Swamplandia.
Mm-hmm.
And when we see that this is Chief Bigtree's way of making money, essentially to be a kind of second-rate carnival barker, it's underscored for us that this is the fate of the family. And in fact, I actually thought that with all the buildup around the park and the mythology and the island, that the letting go of it is quite understated in a way that I liked. John, what did you think?
the book resolves very fast. I mean, it's sort of the struggle to keep it going. And then sort of there's this big denouement and that's it. The book's over.
Like, right.
They move back to they're on the mainland, this thing they've been resisting for their whole lives, both physically and also, you know, mentally. And then boom, they're in it. It's kind of that's it. And we're left with this very weird ending. They're suddenly in this world and a part of this world that they've been resisting for the entire book.
Before we get to the very, very end, can I just say one thing about Grandpa Sawtooth? I love the encounter between Kiwi and Grandpa Sawtooth. So essentially what happens is Kiwi goes to Grandpa Sawtooth, who is, as I said earlier, senile. You know, he flickers in and out of the truth. He lives in an old age home in which everyone is described as looking like Easter eggs because they dress them up in pastel pajamas. And you're reminded of basically Peep's dioramas from her description, you know, that they put the Easter eggs on the, you know, couch and then they move the Easter eggs to the bed and they move them here and there. And so Kiwi goes there stupid looking for satisfaction. He wants to know truths. He wants to know if, you know, does Grandpa Sawtooth understand that Halola died? You know, does he know anything? Does he know how much money they're losing? And this is the moment where Kiwi, who represents a sort of cynical realism, you know, is supposed to be taking us to the moment of reckoning. And yet, I think very cleverly, Karen Russell is not going to let us have that reckoning. She's not going to let Kiwi have it because that's not what it's about. It's right. Not about puncturing the myth and getting to the truth. That's not what's going to get you anywhere. And so he has this unbelievably unsatisfying and actually, you know, demented, violent encounter with his senile grandfather whom he beats up.
Who he beats up when he tells the grandfather that Halola's dead. He breaks the myth. The grandfather doesn't seem to be taking in any information. I mean, there's just no reception on his end. And then when he tells him that Halola is dead, the grandfather has this violent reaction. You know, you're not clear that's why he's violently reacting, but it makes a certain sense, which gives you, again, the power of the myth. When it's broken, the reaction is violent.
But that's not where you're supposed to end up. You're not supposed to end up where Ossie is, kind of deeply lost in a kind of ill fantasy, nor
fog.
Are you supposed to end up in sort of, you know, a listing of facts and truths about – dismal facts and truths about your family.
Right. Although,
that's
but
where
I
you're
think,
supposed to end up?
No. You're not.
You're supposed to end up with the broken pieces of the myth that are still illuminating, which I think
that
is what happens.
That are still sustaining.
But I think – and Kiwi gets there with the father because he hates the father, but then he has this – when he sees his father in the casino in this depressing way. I mean, there's this pure love reaction. And I think maybe because it's a truth he now knows, like he can feel like I felt with Kiwi, it was the myth is broken into pieces and what is between them is truths. He actually gains more nourishment from the truths, and having a few clear ones that he can hold on to is what sort of sustains him more than the continuation of the myth, but that may not be right.
To wrap this up, are these kids going to be okay? Did you think about their futures as they've had to move to mainland Florida?
With the exception of Ossie. Have we mentioned that basically when he rescues Ossie, Kiwi rescues Ossie because he lands his plane that he's learning how to fly so that he can earn more money, lands his plane, she's there, and he rescues her, and he sees that in the distance a noose has been made, and the noose was what Ossie was going to – she was going to hang herself in order to marry Louis Thanksgiving. And according to Ossie, he wouldn't go through with it, which means that portion of her brain told her not to do it, but that it was sort of that close.
And at least the mainland has supplied her with some prescription drugs at the end.
Right. Exactly. And then it's like better living through pharmacology.
Yeah. I mean, then you just have to sort of wrap up the novel. I mean, it is, you know, the plot is, you know, it's a little unsophisticated. And so you have to be a little generous at the end when Kiwi just happens to land his plane and there's Ossie standing there and, you know, Ava hears her voice being called and it all gets wrapped up. And, you know, I guess what you're supposed to be left with is a sense that they have scars. And maybe that's what Ava's rape is actually also partly about, is otherwise Ava is really, you know, sort of a cheerful coming of age who lives in a different novel than her other relatives who are clearly going to be scarred. You know, Kiwi because he bears the weight of the world on his shoulder just by temperament. Chief Big Tree because he is going to lose Swamplandia and, you know, be left in a world of debt. And Ossie because she's mentally ill.
But Ava loses Swamplandia too. I don't actually think she had to be raped.
She loses Swamplandia, but you can, that's true. I mean, you can imagine Ava is going to grow up and be, you know, some sort of zoologist, animal key. I mean, there's lots of great career opportunities available for a sort of brave, animal-loving person such as Ava. So they carry on with the kind of scars and the memory of family love, and it all gets wrapped up quite cheerfully, but appropriately.
John, would you recommend this book?
No, for this reason. It was much more fun talking with you guys about it than it was going through it, reading
Agree. I feel like Hannah added all these layers, and so did you. I was much more appreciative.
But the layers and the – I felt like, not to match the book's voice by coming up with – but it's kind of like one of these impossibly difficult board games that people are loving. And I think the latticework of all the interlocking myths and puncturing of myths and kind of – hard work of here's a symbol and here's another symbol and it's echoing this symbol. And I was wearied by the kind of structure of the whole thing, which felt at times obvious and not carrying me along in a way that I wanted to. And I loved those passages where I was carried along, where the transference of message and metaphor and multiple levels of meaning was conveyed in a more kind of clean way by sort of osmosis, as opposed to point one, this is a reference to this. Point two, this is an echo of that, you know, where – and so I felt patchy in that way. But I actually have quite enjoyed talking about it with you all.
You know what Hannah. I'm going to say. I would say I would definitely selectively recommend it. That is, I'm not going to recommend it to the excessive realists in my life, such as the one that I'm married to, but I will that I happen to be married to, you know, but I would recommend it to certain people that I can think of. And in fact, I'm going to actively do that because I would like to see if anybody was romanced by the novel the way I was, and if maybe it was just due to the fact that I was coming back from a bleary-eyed, you know, midnight reporting trip and reading it mostly on the plane. But see if someone else loves it the way I do.
I think you're not alone. There were many kind reviews, and I'm really interested in what Karen Russell does next.
Yes.
On that note, thank you so much for joining us. It's been really fun. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thanks, Emily.
Bye.